Psalm 31. The psalmist has experienced a serious breakdown, at least I think this is true, you'll have to discern from the psalm, a serious breakdown as a result of the way other people are treating him. He remembers God's love and goodness and the times when his trust in God has been vindicated. And he struggles to find that trust again and to invite others to join him in it. The psalm is written by a person who sees himself as belonging to those bonded to God by fidelity to the covenant. And the Hebrew word is hasidim. He seems to draw on the experience of David as a model, and he doesn't claim to be without fault, as we'll see, but he is innocent of that of which he's being accused. That can often happen in our lives. We're not sinless, we're not faultless, but the actual accusation being made is unjust, out of context, exaggerated, twisted, though we're not going to say we did nothing wrong. But we didn't do what we know, and it's true, that we didn't do what's wrong that we're being accused of. That's his situation. And he wants justice from God, not revenge, which is a little bit better than some of the psalms, against his enemies. Okay, that's my summary. Let's see if it bears analysis as we look. In you, Yahweh, I seek refuge. Do not let me suffer shame. In your justice, set me free. Hasten to hear me. Come quickly to rescue me. Be a fortress where I can find refuge, a stronghold to save me. For indeed, you are my rock and my fortress. For the sake of your name, lead me, guide me. Disentangle me from the net that tightens around me. For you are my defense. Into your hands I commit my ruach, my breath. Spiritus, your spiritus is the Latin word for breath. So my life breath. And we actually do that every time we breathe out, by the way. We give our breath back to the one, because breath is the very thing we don't possess. We have it on borrowed gift. And if you breathe in, God has given you that breath, which of course, without which you cannot live. And then when you breathe it out, what are you doing? You're giving it back. And you may not get it again. But mostly, for us, in any case, we're all still here. So the breath has always been breathed back. So he's saying, I give my breath to you and entrust it to you, trusting that you, as you did with Adam in the myth, you'll come and go, which means that every time you breathe in, God is actually giving you a big hug and a big kiss and saying, look, I'd like to keep you around for a while. So he gives you a big... And that's the prayer that Jesus prayed, placed on Jesus' lips, isn't it, in Luke's gospel, not in Matthew, Mark or John, but in Luke. They're all different artists. Jesus' last breath he gave as a gift back to God. And God did, on the third day, come and he'll do that from the third day for all of us. And it's the same with Stephen. He used the same prayer, because Luke's writing both Luke and the Acts. So he has Stephen dying the way Jesus died, as the first model martyr. The breath is God's gift, that divine gift, which is not part of our makeup, but part of the divine gift which makes what we are alive. And we give it back to God. This has got a lot to do, of course, with many religions, hasn't it? Breathing. I mean, all religions share this obvious insight that breath is a gift to be given and received. And so the whole breathing thing in the Buddhism and Hinduism, in every religion as far as I know, breathing is an important element of prayer, of getting in touch with our breath, our spirit. Verse 5b continues, you have redeemed me, Yahweh, faithful God. Those, you hate those who venerate worthless idols. Idols is something that we create and worship. Whereas what we should be doing is discovering what it is that is to be worshipped, which is already there, and it requires all our mind and all our heart and all our energy to keep penetrating the surface of things to find the sacred, which is the mystery. We don't create it, we discover it. As for me, says our psalmist, I place my trust in Yahweh, not in an idol, something that human beings have created and said, worship it. Whatever, whether it's the banking fraternity or whether it's the advertising people or whether it's the makeup people or whoever make up all these things we're supposed to give our life to, or the car manufacturers, if you're a young lad, you know, whatever it is you're worshipping. We've got to thank our mum and dad, basically, that they showed us something else that makes all that look useful but of no real significance. As for me, I place my trust in Yahweh. I will exult and celebrate your kindness because you have seen my affliction. You've watched over me while I was in danger. You have seen my affliction, echoes one of the classical scenes of the book of Exodus where Moses at the burning bush is encountered by the mystery. The bush is burning but not consumed. There's a presence there of light and fire, and Yahweh says to Moses, I have observed the misery of my people in Egypt. I heard their cry on account of their taskmasters. Indeed, I know their suffering. And it goes on the next line, and I am determined to redeem them. So I want you to do it. Well, if God could redeem them, why doesn't God just redeem them? Why does he go to all the trouble to find Moses to do it? Because that's the way it works, isn't it? If God can make the sun dance, well, why doesn't he? If God can get us to the moon, I mean, God doesn't intervene in organizing things. He creates the world with its own whatever it is. And we human beings have to discover how best, through love, to nurture the planet and to bring about the reign of God on the earth. And if the Hebrews are going to be released from Egypt, God can't do it, if you can understand what I mean by that. He needs you to do it, or Moses to do it. If Moses doesn't do it, just ask somebody else. Because we are the ones who are working in this world. And if we don't do it, it won't be done. Not by us. And if no one does it, it won't be done by anybody. You have not put me at the mercy of the enemy, verse 8. You've set my feet in a broad, open place. Might take you back to Psalm 18 with another little image which picks... I don't think this helps a lot, but just to show you how this imagery keeps coming back. Here's Psalm 18, verse 31. Who is God, says the psalmist, except Yahweh? Who is the rock beside our God? It's Yahweh. The God who girded me with strength and made my way safe. He made my feet like the feet of a deer and set me secure on the heights. Able to escape from the enemy, the ambush, or whatever it was he was in, and he's secure there on the heights. Well, you have set my feet in a broad, open place. Verse 9, be gracious to me, Yahweh, for I am in distress. My eye wastes away from grief, my soul too, and my stomach. He's feeling all that. My life is spent in sorrow. My years go by in sighing. My strength fails because of my guilt. He's done wrong and suffered the consequences, and he knows it's because of his guilt. And my bones waste away. Now, he may have real guilt for a real thing he's done wrong, and that's a healthy reaction. It's not impossible that he's got unreal guilt from expectations of self that are actually wrong. And he may think God is punishing me, so I must have done something wrong, so I have done something wrong, you know. And he's in that spiral that's of no help to him or anybody else. And we don't know which it is, but we can relate to it, the psalm, at whatever level. I am the scorn of my adversaries. My neighbours enjoy themselves at my expense. I'm an object of dread to my acquaintances. Those who see me in the street run the other way. No one thinks of me. That's the translation that I've chosen to use because it's a pretty good one. The Hebrew is, I have passed out of everyone's heart. Lev. Heart and mind. I'll give you both. Both are perfect translations. I have passed out of people's heart and no one's thinking of me. Are two accurate translations of the Hebrew. Because heart and mind are they're not separated at all in the Hebrew language, which is pretty healthy. Sometimes they're separated in me and maybe in you, and that's because of avoidance or bad education or superficiality of an education system which trains the mind without. Now, some people can be highly intelligent intellectually and highly dull emotionally. You know, the emotional intelligence. And we see that on a world scale, might I say. People who might have very high academic degrees and are kind of brilliant, but absolutely stupid when it comes to human relationships. So that's the two extremes. Well, I don't know where I am. I think I'm about 80-20. But when we die, we'll all be 50-50 and it'll all be just so balanced. No one thinks of me. It's as though I was dead. I've become like a useless pot. And here's St. Paul, Corinthians. We've become like the rubbish of the world, the dregs of all things to this very day. These stupid Christians who are... What's wrong with worshipping another couple of dozen gods and having a wonderful time? And they're refusing to do it and they're getting martyred for it. Grow up. Join the mob. I mean, what's another club? Get into it. Another 50,000 poker machines. What's it matter? Get into it. This is life. So, you know, or whatever it is, you know. Join in, but they're standing apart from it and getting martyred for it. And they're stupid. And they believe in the resurrection, for heaven's sake. That's what their contemporaries are saying to Paul. But what they didn't know and what they came to see was how these Christians love one another. They'd found something that no one else knew about. And I think we don't want to be forgetting that people are often envious, aren't they, of someone who's... Well, everyone's envious, I suppose, a bit, of wonderful people who are real and very loving and very wise and very poor often, or whatever, you know what I mean? But they're not poor in what really matters. And anyway, what other people think is hardly the point of it all, but there it is. I hear whisperings of many... You may have been paranoic even. You can still be inspired and be paranoic. But I hear whisperings of many, a bird of ill omen, they're saying, as they scheme together against me and plot to take my life. The same expression comes into Lamentations. It must have been idiom. It's sometimes translated terror on all sides. But a bird of ill omen looks like a better translation. Blindly they wander through the streets, so defiled with blood that no one was able to touch their garments. Away, unclean, people shouted them. Away, don't touch. They become fugitives and wanderers. It was said among the nations, they shall stay here no longer. So that's what's happening. They're being dismissed. But I, our son, I trust in you, Yahweh. I say you... That's historical now. You, the one who did this with Moses, the one you who've been in my life, you are my God. My lot is in your hands. Deliver me from the hand of my enemies who persecute me. Show to your servant your radiant face. In your kindness, save me. So, like a little kid, he wants God to smile. And then you know it's all over. But if Dad has still got that lowering look and Mum looks at you as though you've done something terrible, where do you go? My eldest brother, one of my brothers, so wild when it's a kid, the stories in the family, but so kind of innocent and good. Mum said to him one day, if you use that word again in this house, I'll cut your tongue off. Like he must have used some bad word. And Mum told me this story. About 10 minutes later, in comes this little kid with a knife in his hand, tears pouring down his eyes. And Mum, of course, collapsed in tears herself and hugged him. So honest. He'd used the word. No one had heard it. So he had to own up and say, can you imagine Mum's feelings? So she never said that ever again to anybody in the whole world. And isn't it an interesting story about what children can hear? How careful we have to be with little children. Here he is with tears streaming down his face and a knife in his hand. And anyhow, this, I don't know why I thought of that, but this, he's praying that God will have a smiling face. And there's a lot of gods in this world that aren't smiling. They're very seriously male, seriously militaristic, seriously dull, vengeful, bloody people, seriously into martyrdom or murder or mayhem, aren't they? These gods that our world's big. Here's another little thing from Numbers and one from Daniel about the face. Yahweh bless you and keep you. Yahweh make his face shine on you and be gracious to you. Yahweh lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. Similar image, isn't it? Daniel, let your face shine upon your desolate sanctuary. And now the psalm, I'll just read it for what, straight through verse 17. Do not let me be put to shame, Yahweh, for having called on you. Let the wicked be put to shame. Let them go down in silence to Sheol. Let the lying lips be stilled that speak insolently against the just with pride and contempt. Oh, how abundant is the goodness that you've reserved for those who fear you and have dispensed to those who take refuge in you for everyone to see. In the secret hiding place of your presence, you hide them from human plots. That picks up a lot of John of the Cross's idea that the darkness is actually protective. The dark night of the spirit, the dark night of the soul that we can experience in prayer is dark. It's difficult, but it's also a protection. Because in the dark, you're safer sometimes from something that's trying to get at you. Can't see you, you know. So there's a lot of aspects to the dark. Well, here he's saying, in the secret hiding place of your presence, you know, when you're in church, or I'm in church, I'm dressed up and Mum comes in, usually it's Mum, with a little three-year-old, and Mum wants Father to either bless the child or do something, but there's no way in the world that child's going to. So the child turns around and buries itself in Mum's dress. I mean, it's always happening, isn't it? Because the outside world is not the place to be looking at, and especially this funny looking old man there that's going to be asked to give a blessing. So they're tucked into Mum's thing and you think, what a lovely place to be, kid. You stay there. Don't let anyone pull you out of there. In your tent you hold them safe from their contentious tongues. And concluding, blessed be Yahweh. Yahweh who has shown wonderful kindness to me in his stronghold. I had said in my alarm, I'm excluded from your presence. But you heard my supplications when I cried out to you for help. Love Yahweh, Ahav, A-H-A-B, with a soft B, Ahav, like King Ahab in the northern kingdom. Ahab is the verb to love. Love Yahweh. And love there doesn't mean have feelings for, it means keep the covenant. Honour your commitments, be obedient, listen for God's will, do the will of God. It's got all those things that love is largely about, of course. Fidelity and commitment and doing what has to be done, whatever your feelings might be like. Well, love Yahweh, you his faithful ones. Yahweh preserves those who believe in him, but he repays in full the one who acts haughtily. Be strong, let your heart take courage. All you who hope in Yahweh. and I'll take you to the conclusion of the first letter of Paul to the Corinthians. Similarly, keep alert, stand firm in your faith, be courageous, be strong, let all that you do be done in love.